the show.
Hello, everyone. This is Mott Brown sitting in for Lisa Anderson, our beloved host of The Boundless Show.
Yay, Mott!
She is off this week, and I'm not sure she's doing anything or she has any plans. She just wants to reflect on the Lord's death and resurrection.
That Lisa.
She's an example.
She is for us all.
In her own words, she is a blessing. So, Lisa, we miss you, but we have a great show this week. We have part two of our dating Q&A, which was popular. We got a lot of feedback last week on that segment. And for the culture, we have Tony Perkins, who is the president of the Family Research Council in D.C., and he sits down with Lisa and talks about the trends of young voters. So if you're a young voter, you definitely want to listen to that segment. And finally, for the inbox, we have a question from a listener who is still in school. She's engaged, and she and her fiancé have a lot of schooling left, and they're just asking for advice on what they should do in terms of trying to live on one's salary and how they should go about starting out their marriage. And Steve and Ashley will be here to help answer that. Also this week, we are going to be featuring independent worship band Journey Home. But first, here is part two of Dating Q&A.
Okay, we're going to be talking here about family backgrounds. And this person wants to pursue someone and is possibly in a relationship already, actually, but has like two divorces in their family, a lot of drama, a lot of trauma, and quite frankly, a lot of family issues that aren't even resolved to the point of people in their family not even talking to one another. The other person comes from a crystal clear, squeaky clean family. This person's concerned about introducing the family to this person, even introducing the concept of dysfunction. Is this person even going to want to take this person and their family on and just marry into craziness?
Absolutely. You could look at it like a mission field.
Okay.
No, I'm teasing.
We all sin in many ways, Scripture says. And the squeaky clean family has some issues. Now, granted, it may not be divorce, it may not be alcoholism, it may not be abuse. There are different levels of brokenness, but everybody's broken. And so I would just start there to say to the person whose family is so dysfunctional to say, don't heap added guilt on yourself for your background and feel like this guy or this gal who comes from the perfect background, quote unquote, gets a pass, because we all sin in many ways. And so the danger, I think, for the squeaky clean side is to think they have nothing wrong with them and nothing to work on. And then the other person feels like the problems are all theirs.
My heart really went out to this listener because I read the question and I felt like we had lived the same life. Mm. My parents divorced a lot earlier in life than hers did, but I did come from a background of alcoholism, divorce, some abuse. And when I first started dating my fiance, it was a huge issue in our relationship that I didn't talk to him about. It was this fear, because the more I met his family and hung out with his friends, I saw that he did come from the squeaky clean background. And when I finally brought it up and said, you know, I know you know these things, but can you live with them? Are they deal breakers? And it was so freeing to hear him say the same things that Candace just said, that we all sin in many ways. And not just to say, oh, well, it's okay, I have some sin of my own, don't worry about it, but to say, I know the full extent of your background, and I totally accept that. Not only do I accept that, but I want to walk through that with you. Mm. And I know that there are men out there like my fiance, and so don't give up hope on a relationship. Don't shy away from a potential partner that you may see as having a better background than yours.
And don't reject the concept that he may help you pull away from that dysfunction and get a break from it and get you some distance so you can start to get well. I think that's one of the benefits, is instead of having two people with enormous amounts of the same baggage coming together, it's different kinds of baggage, and there can be some healing there.
It really is. I mean, it some dysfunction is more obvious than others. Mm-hmm. Like, this will be a great question for Beth, because my family is definitely more obviously dysfunctional than hers. But just getting to know her family, living here in Colorado where her family is, I've gotten to know some pretty dysfunctional traits about her family as well. So we're all dysfunctional.
Well, and if you look at the Bible,
some of us have more fun.
If people in the Bible had taken the approach of, you know, I'm only going to marry into a functional family, we wouldn't have had the lineage that brought us Christ. And there's some pretty crazy families along the way. I think the thing to keep in mind is that the person you're marrying had no control over that. don't blame them for their parents and for their relatives, and recognize that a lot of times they're eager to do things right, that they are maybe even more motivated to have a healthy family.
Well, a key thing to ask yourself is this person willing to acknowledge the brokenness and talk about it and deal with it, or are they defending it and prone to repeat it? I think that's the thing you need to weigh.
Yeah. Well, and we would recommend Breaking the Cycle of Divorce, a book that focuses on the family offers by John Trent, who came from a broken home and was worried about his ability to have a strong marriage, and said that there is a certain amount of inertia that could drag you to repeat the mistakes that you experienced, but that doesn't have to be the case. God can redeem.
Okay. All right. Our next question is from a guy who goes to a school where there is a high ratio of males to females, and there aren't a lot of potential suitable Christian women to date. Should he go long distance?
See, how come you can't get those schools together with the schools that have the opposite and have a mixer every once in a while?
I don't know. Are there any schools that have higher ratios of male?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Of women, you mean?
Engineering schools, tech schools.
Okay, yeah.
He's in the one where there's more men, right?
He probably goes to a tech school.
More guys.
Well, Lisa, you know, my fiance Brian goes to Colorado School of Mines, where there's like an 80, I think it's 80 to 20 ratio or something crazy like that.
Men to women.
Men to women.
Okay.
And, you know, he did have to go to Tennessee to find a wife.
This is where it helps to know people who know you well, who are older, and just say, hey, I'm of the age. I'm starting to think about marriage. Do you know any great women you could introduce me to? And when you go home to visit or you go where these mentors are, be open to being set up on a, if not a blind date, at least an introduction.
I mean, college is a great venue to find a spouse because of the time you get to spend with them. And I know I've talked to friends who disdained this idea of meeting somebody in college and then waited until they're in the workforce and then regretted that they didn't take advantage of the time they had to spend with people in college. But that doesn't mean college is the only venue. That there is something to be said for plugging into a good small group and also to recognize that as you develop friendships with mentors, that a lot of times they will have friends and family that they know that they would love to have opportunities to create situations where you get to know each other. Well, so college isn't the only venue.
I think that the venue's fine. He should step up to the challenge. Just because the ratio isn't great, he could still pursue the women that are there.
That'd be a great story to tell.
Well,
I beat so many guys to get your mom.
Even the ones that are currently dating other guys, just snatch them.
Well,
snatch
join
them right
a
out
local church. I'm sure there are single women who aren't at the school, but who still live in that town.
Yeah, because he's definitely in a situation where he is in the minority. I mean, it's rare that you're going to be in a situation where there are more men than women in that setting. Typically, it's going to be the opposite. Mm-hmm. And so he should be able to find other venues where it is the reverse.
Well, I wonder what he means by long distance too. Does he know of women who are in another state or country that he's that he knows about that he can pursue them?
Right.
Or he could be talking about online.
Yeah, and I don't know that online's the best way to go. I would start with asking yourself, who are the women that are in my life, the life that God has put me in? Mm-hmm. Getting back to that sovereignty question, if God's got me in this circle, in this school, in this church, look around where you are first and see if there are any women you might be able to date.
I would say also take advantage of your summer opportunities. If you don't have to work all summer, then go on a 10-week mission trip and spend time with other singles, develop relationships.
That's good.
Mm-hmm. Or come work at Focus on the Family, where there is a higher ratio of single women.
FocusOnTheFamily.com. Come work at the Boundless Show.
Exactly. Yeah, work at the Boundless Show. That's good. Okay, our final question. This is interesting. This girl is dating a guy who had dated someone previously for 4 years, had proposed to her, and she declined. Now he's dating her, and after 4 dates, he asked her if she would consider marrying him. And she was like, whoa, we've only dated 4 times, or gone out 4 times. But at the same time, she likes everything about him, knows his family, this and that. So she thinks he's great. But is there any kind of parameters for what is too soon versus, you know, what may be extending it beyond what needs to happen if they both know they like one another and, you know, two ends of the spectrum?
I don't think there's a magical number in terms of how long you need to know each other. My dad met my mom and they were married in a couple of months later, and they were married for over 30 years before they died. And it is possible to make a great quick connection. But I know there are some other people who encourage some caution. I know Dr. Dobson will say, spend four seasons with each other so that you can see each other in different frames of life. I think that the balance there is you are vulnerable to sexual sin the longer you drag out a relationship trying to see if it's if it has potential. And really, the worst decisions that are made quickly are those that are driven by a physical relationship, where it's the sexual relationship that's driving, propelling the relationship before they've really gotten clarity about what they have. I think it's valuable for them to make sure they've gotten everything on the table, that they've talked about issues like we raised earlier about kids, about in-laws, about money, instead of blindly moving in and just assuming all that they're on the same page on all those issues. Those kind of inventories can really help them feel more confident.
Lisa, does it say how long he had been broken up when they started dating?
Yeah, it looks like about 3 months. He came out of this four-year relationship 3 months ago. But this current girl, that he has known her for most of his life.
I think that that is a total deal changer in the affirmative. It makes it a good thing because they have this lifelong friendship. And so she has seen him in all these different seasons Steve mentioned. And so I would say if she feels good about it, she should at least say to him, yeah, I'm open to it. Let's spend a little more time, you know, vetting this possibility and meeting with a mentor couple. Of course, I'm going to say that because I always say that, but get a mentor relationship going here and pursue the possibility. Yeah, I think it's, you have every reason to be hopeful and excited.
Well, there you have it, folks. We just did 2 weeks on dating and relationship questions. So, of course, we always want to hear from you. These questions come from you, folks. So write to us at editor@boundless.org, and maybe we'll do this sometime in the future, maybe on some other topic like diseases or finances or issues, psychoses, whatever. So we need to hear from you. Today's culture segment, I have with me in the studio, Studio A from the Hill here in Colorado Springs, Tony Perkins. Welcome, Tony.
Lisa, good to be with you.
Tony Perkins is the president of the Family Research Council. For those of you who know of FOCUS, you know that we work very closely with the Family Research Council, which is headquartered out actually in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, next to the other hill in Washington, D.C.
Next to the other hill, yes, and is very involved in issues, public policy issues, specifically ones that affect the family, and doing their best, doing a great job out there to reflect core issues of value and biblical truth as they affect public policy. So we're glad to have you here.
Thank you, Lisa. Good to be with you.
Well, Tony and I were just in a session this morning that was extremely extensive. I think it was about 3.5 hours of meeting with Frank Luntz. Some of you may know of Frank Luntz. He is considered one of the premier pollsters in the nation, an expert on public opinion, someone who not only in the realm of public policy, though that is certainly a specialty, but in culture and trends, how things are going in the way of our nation. And he spoke to us, a team of us leaders here at Focus on the Family this morning. He's also the author of Words That Work, It's Not What You Say, It's What People Hear, and was really kind of taking us to task, not only Focus. We invite people like Tony and other folks from the community here so that we don't get the only battering ram.
Yeah, you want to share the pain.
We want to share in the grief, yeah, yes. Okay. But he had some pretty hard words for us in what it looks like to communicate a message that he believes is principled and in many senses right, but sometimes we don't do that in the best possible way. Now, Tony, you're in the middle of this. You've been in the middle of it. What was your first reaction to him kind of calling us to the carpet?
Well, I mean, I'm actually tracking with Frank. I mean, I think we've seen that. I've been at the Family Research Council for 5.5 years after spending about 8 years in public office, and you know, I'm kind of, I see this from both generations. I'm kind of in between in that my parents' generation that, you know, watched Dr. Dobson and, you know, I was brought up on Dare to Discipline and I've got the marks to prove it. But that was kind of where my parents saw things, and things began to evolve. I mean, during my time in school is when, you know, the whole idea of evolution came in, creationism was out, God was out, the Bible was out. And so it's a different world, and it's gotten even worse since, you know, I left school. And so there's a void in this common language and a common understanding and a common ethic that at one time drew America together. I mean, we're a very fragmented society. And so knowing that, how do we communicate in such a way that we can bring the pieces together? And I think what Frank was talking about was, you know, hey, look, you know, the language that we have are accustomed to hearing on Sundays is great for the church crowd, but it doesn't necessarily help us reach into the neighborhoods. And, you know, I thought it was very fascinating because if you listen to some of the things he said, there are parallels to Jesus Christ in how he ministered. And this was brought home to me about 2 months ago. I was up in New York visiting with, having lunch with a group from Anderson Cooper, AC360, and Campbell Brown, their producers. And it was about an hour and a half session. They were just asking me questions. And, you know, New York values are a little different than, you know, values in Louisiana or other places in the world. Mm-hmm. And a number of the staff were homosexuals. And they began to quiz us about, well, how can you support marriage? Or, you know, this prohibiting us from being able to marry, why, you know, how does our relationships affect you? And, you know, and I could sense in there this this sense of condemnation that has come from those who, you know, are just protecting the institution of marriage because it's important and because it provides the best place for children. I mean, children are nurtured by a mom and a dad. I mean, we know that from history. It's not just two parents. It's not, you know, two dads or two moms. I mean, if that were the case, three moms would be better than two moms. It's a mom and a dad. And I don't think we've done a really good job in talking about why these things are important. And as I was reflecting on it, I was praying about it later. And, you know, as we develop in our walk with Christ and we develop a biblical worldview, it really is that question that was popular a few years ago, what would Jesus do? And a great example of how Jesus confronted the culture and confronted these issues was found in John chapter 4, where he had the conversation with the Samaritan woman at the well. And it really, I was thinking about that this morning as Frank was talking, because it tracked perfectly with what Frank was saying. First, he had a conversation with him, mm-hmm. with that lady. And so often we go out of our way as Christians not to have a conversation with people we disagree with. Well, I think we have to make ourselves vulnerable to having that conversation and entering into that relationship. And then he actually made himself vulnerable by asking her for a drink of water. And if you read it in context, she kind of capped on him. She came back and said, well, you know, why would you ask me for water? Jesus didn't bite on that. And as Christians, we have to realize there's some hostility in the culture built up against us. And when we enter into this conversation, you know, and somebody pushes back, hey, we just have to let that slide. And then he began to zero in on her need. He was talking about that she thought a temporal need about the water and about this living water. But here's where it gets really interesting. She goes, well, I'm interested in that living water. Tell me a little bit more about that. And Jesus says, all right, go get your husband and I'll tell both of you about it. And she really quickly begins, she wants to change the subject. I don't have a husband. And he goes, you know what? You're right. You don't have a husband. You've had five. In fact, the man you're with now is not your husband. You see, we're being told in the church that in order to get where we need to go, we need not to confront. Mm-hmm. But in that situation, Jesus did confront. But here's the next step. His confrontation had a powerful impact. And I think it was because what Frank was talking about, it was the language that Jesus used. It was his tone. It was his body language. It was the relationship that he had established just in that brief encounter. That his confrontation of her immoral lifestyle brought conviction rather than condemnation. And I think that's where we've got to go in the church, is it building that goodwill by having the conversation, not backing away from confronting what is right and wrong, or somehow, avoiding the truth. And Frank said that. He said, you know, don't change your message. But I think ultimately our goal needs to be to touch the lives of people so that they're better, both now and in the future.
Yeah, and I really liked what he said, how, you know, I think that bears out in that story that you just told, as well as many of Jesus' other parables and instructions, is the power of asking questions and the power of rhetorical questions.
Yeah. Jesus,
and
if you ask, he did all the time.
If you ask questions, he asked the woman that question. She answered her own question. She knew the truth. And in declaring the truth and making that public and recognizing it, she's basically telling the truth to herself.
I mean,
and there's no argument for that.
I mean, think about it. Was Jesus ever really looking for an answer?
Right.
I mean, right. He knew everything.
Probably knew, yeah.
So it's very powerful in the way Jesus engaged people, is that he asked questions. And that's exactly what Frank Luntz was talking about, is that instead of, you know, these statements declaring, you know, we ask these rhetorical questions that allow other people to arrive at the conclusion. And that's, you know, truth is truth, and truth is continually popping back up as being very effective.
Mm-hmm. My mother is definitely of the older generation. I'm the youngest of six kids, and I think I've said this before on the show, how it's funny when I talk with her, whether it's about policy or just culture type things. My mom is of the generation that wants to be told what to do. She loves Dr. Dobson because he will tell her what to do, and she will go and do it. And when I talk to my friends, even believing friends, they want to be part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of, how do we invite people into the conversation, knowing that as believers, they will have that compass, they will have the understanding that, yes, this is biblically true. And if they do have that understanding, then yes, it's going to come around to truth again. But it's kind of more that grassroots effort of building that relationship, in the sense that when we were in this meeting this morning, when I spoke up once and just talked about, we were talking about Rick Warren and just the positive impression that he often leaves on the media and in those that he's worked with. And it was kind of that, well, you know, why has he done so well in that, inauguration prayer aside and all that, you know, hoo-ha, whatever. But but I said, you know what, I've met Rick Warren twice in my life. The first time he asked my name and he asked a couple things about me as a person. Then months later, I met him a second time. How, I do not know, but he remembered my name and he followed up on those questions he had asked me personally.
You must have left an impression.
And I don't know. I mean, no, I think this guy is talented. I don't know. I mean, but I knew that when he talked to me, he was looking at me, and it wasn't you are here to shepherd me around your campus and help me do what I need to do here. He connected with me personally, and I just shared with the group there. I said, you know, I may disagree with Rick on some things. I may agree with him on every other thing, whatever the situation is and how I feel about him. I will always listen to him because I will never forget how he connected with me personally, mm-hmm. and took time to know me personally. And I think that's where when you were saying getting out into the community and having that understanding of these people with whom we may differ, building that common ground is going to give us that voice.
Yeah, my wife's taught me a little bit about that. You know, especially men have this tendency to be problem solvers, and so they can put out, all right, this is what we need to do. And, you know, first couple of years of marriage, my wife would come in and say, you know, hey, we got this problem. I said, all right, this is what you need to do. Finally, she said, I don't want you to tell me what to do. I just want you to listen. And so now, you know, I just listen and let her solve all the problems. Life's much easier now.
No, just talk. She just wants to talk about the problems.
That's right. Well, with five kids, there's always something to talk about.
Exactly. That's what my girlfriends say, the ones who are married. They're like, you know, I was just trying to tell my husband, you know, I just wanted to vent. I just wanted to talk about it. I didn't want him to solve it. Yeah, but he cut me off.
But, you know, there's some application there to the broader culture is that I think everyone recognizes the problems. I mean, there are few people that could say America is A-OK. I mean, he shared a statistic which has actually been, I saw last year, about 18 months ago. The New York Times and CBS ran a poll asking Americans, is America on the right track? He had apparently what was an updated version of that same question. The percentage is still the same. 81% of Americans say the nation's on the wrong track. So Americans, you know, people out there know we're on the wrong track. But I think it's your point in that what we arrive at is a consensus on how we solve these problems. And in that process, and I have learned a little bit about this from being in elected office and being in a legislative body, is that consensus is built when everyone's able to share their ideas. Now, are they all as valid? I mean, you know, I'm not there with some of the younger generation that said every idea has the same validity as the next idea. I still have a problem with that. But they have a right to share it. And I respect their right to share that information. But they don't have to, I mean, I don't have to believe it. But they have a right to share it, and so I'm fine with that.
That's a great Frank talking point, by the way. He mentioned that this morning. You know, it's like you can say, I respect your right to believe that, and that's a good entree.
Well, and I think, but I mean, if you go back, that's biblical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, God himself did not force us to make certain choices. I mean, God, in going all the way back to the beginning, if you believe the Bible, which I happen to believe, you know, God created Adam and Eve, and he gave them a choice in the garden. He said, look, the place is yours. Do whatever you want, but don't eat from that tree over there. Now, if he didn't want to give them a choice, then he would have never put that tree there. And so I think, you know, we cannot do anything different than what God himself did. We can put all the facts out there and say, look, if you choose this path, you know, life is going to be much better for you, for your children, and for the community as a whole. But we can't force you to do that. That's up to you. That's your choice. You have that choice. Now, it gets complicated when we get into the public policy because people would then say, well, then why don't you just allow women to have a right to choose abortion or, you know, same-sex couples to marry? They have a choice to choose a particular lifestyle and to make decisions that affect them and their children. But then as a community, when we begin to shape policy that would put that choice on the level of a, you know, destructive choice, on the same level as a positive choice, then we're making collective decisions. I mean, an example of that would be, I mean, we know from the social science and from history what is best for children. It's best for children to grow up in a two-parent home, a mom and a dad who are biologically related with the children. Now, that's the ideal situation. Now, we know we fall short of that many, many times. But should we not in our public policy shoot to encourage that which is best, which we know are going to lead to the best outcomes for children? Economically, they're going to turn out better, less chance of being in poverty. They're going to turn out better educationally, higher achievement in education. They're going to be better off in terms of employment later on in life. Socially, they're going to be better adapted to relationships. So should we not then aspire to what is best, knowing that, yeah, we're going to fall short. We're not going to make it all the time. But as our public policy, we promote that which is best.
Okay. So as you're sitting now in Washington, D.C. with your team, and we have a new administration, and you know we're facing, you know, talking to new up-and-coming generations, and we're in all kinds of crises that we all know about, and we're all at various different levels of freaking out about them. What do you see as the task for 09 and beyond for you and your team, especially Tony, as you kind of have the pulse of what's going on in policy and beyond?
Well, I think we're in a, and I think, that, again, referencing the meeting with Frank Luntz, I think we're in a transitional period where we are seeing kind of a generational change in America. And, you know, we cannot abandon the truths and the principles upon which this nation was founded upon which the future rests. But we do need to change how we communicate them and reach to a generation that doesn't have the necessarily have the appreciation for those, because, you know, I think most young people would agree that they've been shortchanged somewhat in their education. And I think, looking back on it, I think one of the areas is in the history. We don't understand what brings us together and unites us as a people. We have a unique history and heritage as Americans. And so I think part of what we have to do is, number one, we've got to begin a conversation with the next generation of leaders and adults in this country. Then I think it's part of an exchange, but in that exchange comes an education process of these time-tested truths, which, you know, any successful society has embraced. But they've got to become part of their moral framework. They can't live in the moral framework of their parents just because their parents lived there. It has to become their own. And so I think that is part of our challenge. Now, that's a cultural challenge. I'll have to be very frank from a political standpoint. I mean, our mission is to shape public policy as it pertains to families from a Christian perspective. I think most of what we're doing in Washington right now is defensive in posture, is that we're just trying to keep, you know, the bad stuff at bay while the culture, the other cultural elements are engaged in helping shape the way people think and understand life. And I know that the upcoming generation has... Well, I shouldn't just say the upcoming generation. I think all of us have lost confidence in government. We've lost confidence in many institutions, the church. Mm-hmm. But I would just say this, and I know I'm probably going against the flow, according to what Frank says. don't give up on the church. The church is not an institution. It is not a building. It is the body of Christ. It is a living organism. It is collectively those who have put their faith and trust in Jesus Christ. Yes, of different stripes, different backgrounds, different colors, different ethnic groups, but we have commonality. And I think more than anything, what's needed in America today is something that we all have in common. And I think the church, the body of Christ, can play a key role in bringing this nation back together.
Okay. And I want to get back to that really quickly, but I just want to ask you one other question. When you talked about, you know, the focus of what we're doing is kind of stemming the tide and pushing back the darkness in the metaphorical sense.
Well, I would say keeping the barbarians at bay, but that's not politically correct.
Exactly. So. Exactly like that. So why do you think, because that amazed me this morning when Frank was talking about, you know, look, we are the majority. You know, most people put as their top value having a healthy mm-hmm. family. Mm-hmm. Most people will say that they care about the spiritual health of their kids. Most people, you know, he talked about the African-American community on Prop 8, voted overwhelmingly for it. They support traditional marriage, yet sure. they overwhelmingly vote Democratic. What do we need to do to, why are we just fighting this when really we should be the majority, Tony?
Well, I think, I mean, let's step back even further, go back past California this past summer in Prop 8, which, you know, amazed and enraged some people that, you know, in one of the most liberal states, most populous, most liberal states in the country, traditional marriage still had the vast majority of people supporting it. But you go back to 2004, the year after Massachusetts imposed same-sex marriage on that state, and you know, spontaneously, independently, you had 14 other states the next year pass marriage amendments. And we've got 29 states now that have passed those. Now, would every person who went into the voting booth and voted for traditional marriage, would they say, I'm a part of the religious right? No, they wouldn't. Because in part, the religious right has become a derogatory term mm-hmm. That has been used to marginalize people who have really advocated and advanced the ideas that most people agree with. And so I would say that our values, our morals, our moral construct is very similar. But how we would define ourselves and be defined by others is different. So I think and I have learned that instead of focusing on the politics of the matter, focusing on the labels, I know it's descriptive, conservative, liberal, and I use those terms. I try not to use those as much, but focus on the facts, the policy ideas, and let people determine for themselves, is that a good idea, is that a bad idea?
That's good, yeah. Yeah, and I would just say, wrapping up, I mean, I think that's huge, and I think policy is important, and we need to be involved. And for those who don't understand history, I mean, I thought it was overwhelming when he said this morning how, they polled all these Ivy League students and they can't even name senators or congressmen from their own areas. Yeah. They don't even know what's going on. Okay, if you are listening and you do not know what is going on, I am angry with you and you better fix it. So, anyway, just write to us, editor@boundless.org, and we'll fix you somehow.
Well, policy. I mean, I just think people should realize that policy is important because it shapes our culture. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a two-way street. Culture also shapes policy. But policy puts in place certain things, and especially now as more and more emanates from government. Not a good thing, in my opinion. But government leaves such a big footprint in that it does shape our culture. And I think that's why we've got to at least be engaged in the conversation. Doesn't mean we're going to get our way or we should expect to get our way every time. But at least our voice should be in the mix.
Yeah. And here's where I think there's especially some hope, Tony. It's what you said about the church. And this is where every one of our listeners can get out right now and get started. And that is in the relationships with their family members and their coworkers, the people that are in their lives that they have, that they can start these conversations with. And that is so important. I mean, and we know, civic responsibility is huge, and get out there and do that too. But at the same time, to have those relationships, I mean, again, those of you out there, that our demographic is sitting in movie theaters because we want to be part of a bigger story, and we feel like we're not living that story in our own lives, and that is sad, and we're trying to find that vicariously through some other story that has been crafted, and it's why Hollywood is so powerful. But at the same time, through real relationships, we can start doing that right where we are and impacting people. And it's just, huge. It's that one life touching another life.
And I think, and part of the challenge especially is, and I, 12 years ago, I authored the nation's first covenant marriage law, which in fact brought me my first time here to Focus 12 years ago to do a program on that. But there are so many folks out there, younger people, that have never seen a successful relationship. Mm-hmm. And they think it's out of their reach. And it's not. I mean, are there tools that we need to work on? And yes, I mean, we've got to get some tools. We've got to improve our ability to communicate and understand. And just what we've been talking about in terms of us reaching the culture, same thing applies to two individuals reaching one another. I would just say, look, it's amazing today. We were talking earlier about the Twittering and Facebook and the social networking. And, I was Twittering I realized that everybody's talking, but nobody's listening. Hmm. I mean, it's just, and we all want to be heard, but we're not really interacting. And while all this social networking is good, are we really communicating? Are we really meeting those relationship needs? Or is it a substitute? We need those personal relationships. We need to build those personal relationships one-on-one. And as a church, we need to build those relationships outside the walls of the church.
That's huge. Okay, well, the book we referred to, again, like I said, we were in a conversation with Frank Luntz this morning. His book is Words That Work. It's not what you say, it's what people hear. And I have been talking with Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council. Check out what they are doing at frc.org. Again, that's FRC.
Let me put in a plug, too, for my book.
Yes.
Personal Faith, Public Policy, which talks about some of those things that Frank talked about.
Personal Faith, Public Policy. Check it out, by Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council. Tony, thanks so much for joining me today.
Lisa, good to be with you. As you clear away the rubble, things that crowd my heart, Lord, be gentle.
here for this week's Inbox. We have Steve and Ashley. Hi, guys.
Hey, Mott.
Thank you for being here. We have a question from Emily, and I'll just go ahead and get into it. My boyfriend and I are planning to get married in a little over a year. He is still working on a bachelor's degree, but has plans to go to med school. When we marry, I will still have 2 years left of school. I have read articles with advice to live on only one salary, but how does this translate with couples that are still in school?
Emily, this really is an important question, because what you're talking about is two conflicting approaches to how people go about getting their education and then starting their life in marriage. And what we've noticed is that a lot of parents went into college and took the approach you did in terms of meeting someone they love and then wanting to get married and then figuring out what they do about their education. And then a lot of them report later just how much of a struggle it was to get married before finishing their education and then figuring out how they're going to pay bills, who's going to potentially stop their education flow and try to provide for the other person. And we've even heard horror stories about people who have stopped and tried to provide for their spouse to get through college, and then the marriage falls apart and they're stuck with without their degree finished and maybe even with a baby there. And so there's a mindset now that says, do what is going to put you in the most secure position. And a lot of times that does mean waiting until far out of college, getting in the most perfect financial situation possible, getting all your degrees under your belt so that you're not going to be hurt and abandoned. And there's some, it's easy to understand why people would take that approach. But we at the same time have heard from so many mentors who during that same season of life found out that they could make it work, that they were able to rally around the other person, and that they recognized there were benefits in going ahead and getting married and realizing that even though they were going to have to make new sacrifices, it was better than dealing with the sexual temptation, dealing with creating these two financially independent lives, but going ahead and building their lives together. And many of them will say, boy, those were hungry years, trying to do all that work, squeezed into tight apartment, but said that those were some of the best years of their life. Now, let me just point out, though, unless you've got some very generous scholarships that are paying your way through school, or you've got some generous benefactors, friends, family members who are making it possible for both of you to be full-time students and still have a place to live and pay the bills and all that, you are probably going to have to take turns rallying around each other. And to any guy, I mean, if in your situation, Emily, you decide to help your husband through medical school, I want to speak to your fiance and say, it is your job to be the provider for this family. And if your wife makes sacrifices for the next few years to make it possible for you to be a provider later, don't you dare dishonor her sacrifice and abandon her like some people have, and take advantage of the sacrifice she's making to help you through, to put her graduation plans on hold, to put her career goals, and do everything you can when it makes sense to help her to get the education completed that she was hoping to complete, even if it's after a season of babies or however it's structured, to demonstrate great thankfulness for that sacrifice.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that when she's asking for advice to live on only one salary, that's something that you don't necessarily have to do coming out of school. It's something that you want to prepare for when children happen, because you, especially if you want to stay home with your child, so you can both work, you can pay off bills if that's what you want to do. It's about not being handcuffed by the buying decisions you make early on, whether it's too much house or too much car debt. And that's what we talk about a lot on Boundless, about living on one salary.
Another thing that I would add to that in a practical sense is the importance of expectations, not just financial expectations, but just living situation and the things that you have. If you're two college students and you're married, you're not going to have that new sofa from Pottery Barn, and yeah, you're not going to have a new Kenmore dishwasher. And that's okay, as long as you know going into it that for a little while you're going to be sitting on lawn furniture and you're going to be sleeping on your husband's college futon. And make the best of those times. Yeah. Have fun with that. You know,
that's right.
count the cost.
And just realize it is for a season, and that you might have a structure in terms of how you're both lean and mean and working hard and making sacrifices and clipping coupons and doing everything you can to stretch your resources. That isn't necessarily indicative of the rest of your life, that it really is a foundation. But we come back to the idea that even though your culture and everybody around you would say, go the safest, most secure route and hold off on getting married 5-6 years from now, to realize there are some good reasons to find a way to make it work now. And there are some wonderful memories that you can develop of building a life together instead of building a life apart that you try to combine again later once you've developed a very independent approach to your finances and your time. And once again, dealing with the sexual temptation all along the way.
Steve, what advice would you give if something happens, like if they get pregnant or if they lose a job or a financial crisis hits?
It's always easy to think of your perfect plan and also to have a context that the future is always going to be better, greener financial pastures, and just keep holding off and waiting. But life is happening right now. And if you're committed and you build on your vows and you're absolutely not going to forfeit your vows, but you're going to make this work, that regardless of what comes up, if you end up having a baby before you thought, or you end up having a new career direction, to realize that it's the vows that you're holding on to at this time, and you're not waiting to gauge the potential of marriage for much further down the road, waiting for the perfect scenario.
Well, thanks, guys. I hope this helps Emily and to all our other listeners. If you have a question or a comment, write us at editor@boundless.org. I'm Mott Brown, filling in for Lisa Anderson.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org, focused on the family.